It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Folk music legend Pete Seeger passed away last night. We pulled up a clip from a WPR interview back in 2007. Pete Seeger tells WPR's Gene Faraca how he and his wife Toshi foiled an assassination attempt through the power of song.
You had an instance in your life where an assassin showed up at one of your concerts fully intending to kill you.
Yeah. Well, he had been from a small town, and they'd all gone to serve in Vietnam, and a whole batch of his friends had been killed, and he was just furious. Who was this crazy Seegers stabbing me in the back with these songs? Well, he was a rather quiet guy, and I first didn't know whether to believe him, but this guy said, Pete Seeger, could I talk to you a minute? I came here intending to kill you. There were a lot of things going on. I was kind of busy. I thought maybe I'd just shake hands, but Toshi said, sit down. And we talked, and then we sang Where Have All the Flowers Gone together, both of us. And he stood up and shook my hand. He says, I feel clean now.
And that was Pete Seeger talking to Gene Faraca here on the Ideas Network back in 2007. He passed away yesterday at the age of 94.
Coming up on Central Time, confrontations are likely this weekend over a law limiting access to a proposed iron mine site in Wisconsin. We'll hear what protesters, police, and the mining company are saying.
First, tonight President Obama will deliver his fifth State of the Union address, and he's expected to focus on the economy. Officials in President Obama's administration have already said that he plans to announce a minimum wage raise.
At the start of a congressional election year, the speech and the message that the president lays out is likely to be particularly important for his fellow Democrats. After some of them got frustrated with the White House after the problematic launch of the federal health care exchange site late last year.
You can hear coverage of the address at 8 o'clock this evening here on Wisconsin Public Radio or online at WPR.org.
Here with us now to preview the State of the Union address is Politico's deputy White House editor, Rebecca Cinderbrand. Rebecca, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we teased the congressional elections a moment ago. What role does this speech tonight play in those elections?
Well, you know, what we're expecting to hear tonight is really sort of a preview of the message Democrats are, at least at this point, planning to use on the campaign trail this year, or at least the president is planning to push on behalf of his party on the campaign trail this year. It's a message of about income inequality. It's a message about economic opportunity. It's focused on sorts of kind of bread and butter economic issues that have been polling particularly well. We're talking about an increase in the minimum wage. We're talking about extending unemployment benefits, issues that really go to the heart of working class appeal for Democrats.
A lot of the talk leading up this has been about that inequality issue. Are you expecting a lot of almost a sociological treatise on inequality in the United States or more, I guess, hands-on practical steps that Democrats are going to be pushing for?
We're going to hear a little bit of both. So, you know, one of the things that Democrats have really been looking for from this speech, and they've been assured by the White House that they're going to get it, is a tone. The president kind of shifting the conversation, setting the tone, talking in big picture language about where the struggle right now over income inequality stands in their view, and where it needs to head. Kind of, you know, the conversation in Washington about the economy over the past few years, a lot of it has been focused on spending, on cutting spending, on the deficit. And really what Democrats are looking for is a sort of sea change in that focus, spending more time talking about making sure that the benefits of economic growth filter down to the middle class and to working class people. And so they're looking for the president to talk about that, but they're also looking for specifics. So, you know, we already know the White House already announced that the president is going to be formally announcing an executive order that will raise the minimum wage for workers for federal contractors to $10.10 an hour. Of course, that's not something that he can do for the rest of the country without congressional action. But this is the sort of, you know, limited actions that he's going to both talk about that he can take on his own and call on Congress to take as well.
That's been another theme in the coverage leading up to this. How much will President Obama do things he can go it alone on via executive orders? How much will he be giving pep talks or kicks in the butt to Congress to do things?
You're going to hear both, but of course, you know, one of the big focuses for the White House and that the president has really been stressing over the past few months is his willingness, his increasing willingness to, where he feels Congress either isn't able to or is unwilling to take action, his willingness to take action himself where he can. Again, you know, a lot of this is very much, you know, vision meeting reality. A lot of the moves that the president would like to take are either very limited or may hit some resistance, perhaps from industry or stakeholders, or may not actually translate on the ground. But these are areas where he's looking to take the steps that he can, using the tools available to him in the executive branch, where he feels that Congress is unwilling to move.
How much has he been doing this already?
This is absolutely something he's been doing all along. But of course, you know, he's really stepping it up now as he moves into, you know, the midway point of his second term, and of course, bringing on board someone like John Podesta, who is now going to be acting as a senior advisor in the White House, was a real signal that he's looking to kind of harness all the tools of the executive branch and use all of the tools at his disposal and really become much more active on this front, not necessarily waiting for Congress to move.
And that's been drawing criticism from Republicans, hasn't it, saying this is a bit of a power grab.
Right. And you know, that's traditionally what you hear in response. Obviously, you know, the opposing party never likes to see the president really, in their view, making an end run around congressional approval. But, you know, again, these are, to some extent, somewhat limited. You know, again, when we were talking about the minimum wage, this is a very limited step the president is able to take. If this is a step that he wanted to, you know, involve the entire country, have it affect as many people as possible, he'd have to get congressional buy-in. And so, you know, with a State of the Union speech, it's traditionally not, you know, a partisan red meat speech. You don't necessarily see the president using it to attack the other party, whichever president may be in power, you know, to attack the opposing party. But at the same time, he's clearly talking past the members of Congress who are sitting in front of them. He's clearly speaking to the country as a whole. And so he's looking to kind of sell his own party's agenda in a very kind of limited non-campaign speech style.
When it comes to the big picture economy, what do we expect from the president as far as the recovery from the Great Recession?
So, you know, the message that we're expecting to hear from the president and the tone we're expecting is it's not a victory lap per se, but it will clearly be the president making the case that the economy has turned the corner, that things are improving slowly and steadily. You know, you've had the White House pointing at consecutive quarters of job growth. You've had this sense from the White House, at least, that the economy has turned the corner and that it's safe to point that out. It's kind of the same tone that we've heard and expect here when it comes to the Affordable Care Act. Again, you know, a rocky rollout, something Democrats were very concerned about. The feeling now that, you know, with the signups under all aspects of the Affordable Care Act reaching roughly 3 million people with some form of health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, that has turned the corner, at least when it comes to glitches. And so it's a similar sort of message. Things aren't set. Absolutely, it's not where you would like to see it, either on the economy or on Obamacare, but things are heading in the right direction. That's the message from the president tonight.
And getting back to that congressional election, we've seen a lot of signs from Republicans that they think the Affordable Care Act can be a winning issue for them. We've seen signs for Democrats along the lines of bring it on. It's not something that's going to win it for you. Is that still, do you think both parties are looking at that as a tactic?
Oh, absolutely. That's going to be a hot-button issue on the trail. But, you know, we're a long way from Election Day. And the interesting thing is exactly how it's going to play on the trail. You know, obviously, Democrats were extremely concerned last fall. They, you know, sat down. We know that there were talks with, you know, senior advisors in the White House basically telling them that the Senate was at risk for Democrat control of the Senate if things continued in that direction. And things absolutely had to be shifted and changed. It was an emergency if Democrats wanted to hold on to that chamber. Now you see a sense that, again, it may not be an automatic win. This is at least what Democrats are saying, that that message may not be an automatic win for Republicans. There's been a shift in Republican messaging, and there's been a shift in Democratic messaging. The White House has reopened its political office, a scaled-down political office, but they're coordinating messaging and talking about ways to sell the Affordable Care Act. We've seen increasing visibility from the White House. You know, the First Lady out there more and more kind of, you know, talking about the Affordable Care Act in a more visible way, the president himself being more vocal about it. And so, you know, there's a sense that, again, with the worst of the technical glitches behind it when it comes to the website, now the benefits have actually begun with January 1st, and particularly with an expected surge in enrollment again as the next deadline nears. You know, the six-month deadline after which, you know, the open enrollment period for this year closes, that there is a sense that perhaps it won't be, perhaps it may not be the automatic win that Republicans may assume.
That's Rebecca Cinderbrand. She's Deputy White House Editor at Politico. She sticks with us to talk about President Obama's State of the Union address tonight, and you can join the conversation. What would you like to hear President Obama say in tonight's speech? If you could ask him a question and have him answer it, what would that be? Do you agree with President Obama's use of executive orders to enact change, things he can do without Congress's help? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We are Central Time on WPR. We're speaking with Rebecca Cinderbrand. She's Deputy White House Editor at Politico, talking about President Obama's State of the Union address tonight. And you can join in. What do you want to hear from the president? If you could ask him a question, what would you ask him? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get your calls in just a few moments. Rebecca, I wanted to ask about immigration. That's something that the president, the White House, have pushed for reform on for a while now. There have been plans that have passed the Senate, plans to pass the House, but not the same thing. What are we expecting to hear from the president tonight on the issue?
Well, we're expecting the president to take a pretty careful tone when it comes to immigration. You know, even a few short months ago, it seemed as though there was absolutely no hope of any progress to be made, that immigration was dead. Now it feels like there's some signs of life. We know that Speaker Boehner is going to be speaking with his caucus this week and going to be talking about possible next steps when it comes to immigration. And so, you know, it's key from the White House perspective, that, you know, that the president doesn't do anything that would seem to antagonize Republicans, that would kind of invite some sort of pushback when there seems to be the possibility of some sort of movement on the issue. And so expect the president to take a careful tone tonight, calling for his priorities, but not necessarily hammering the opposition.
So no scolding here on this issue.
Exactly. A very careful tone is what we're expecting, at least at this point.
Do you think he'll make some serious nods to bipartisanship? Is he going to say anything that both sides genuinely stand up and applaud?
Well, you know, this is the speech for it. You know, traditionally, again, you know, the State of the Union, not necessarily your time for your red meat partisanship. You know, you kind of deliver those careful partisan digs, and you try to frame them in a way that you can, at least for viewers at home, seem to be inviting some sort of bipartisan buy-in, even if the folks sitting there may get that you're not necessarily, making offering the sort of agenda that everyone can buy into. Folks at home want to hear the president laying out an agenda that at least everyone in the country feels like they can embrace.
Go to our phones now. We've got Fred in Liberty joining us at 800-642-1234. Fred, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I guess, if anything, I'd like to hear him talk about, you know, some of the, you know, he seemed like he's going to retract a lot of the previous administration's wrongdoings and whatnot when he got in there in 08, and there was all this ballyhoo about universal health care and, you know, ending the wars. And what do we have now? We live in a security state. We have, you know, a corporate mandated backroom deal insurance scam that's bilking the average working person and forcing them into institutional poverty. It's a crime. And I don't know. If anything, I'd like to see him lay his head on the block or something. He seems like a real D-bag.
All right, Fred. Well, a couple things there, Rebecca. Some strong thoughts. Criticism of the president from the left. Do we see that coming from the left wing of the Democratic Party in Congress? Are they worried about maybe too moderate a message?
Well, again, you know, our reporters spoke to members of the Progressive Caucus and other liberals ahead of the president's speech, asking them, what is it that you want to see? What is it that you're expecting to hear from the president tonight? And, you know, they had some pretty strong thoughts, but the key for them wasn't even necessarily, you know, specific policy proposals, although they did have a pretty lengthy laundry list of proposals that they wanted to see. But it was more, again, that tone, shifting the conversation, moving Washington, the focus in Washington, the national conversation for pundits and others, away from this focus on spending and more in the direction of these income inequality issues, focusing on the needs of the working class and ways to make life easier for folks who are still struggling or maybe still unemployed and trying to find proper work in this economy. They want to hear the president's tone, and they want him to make sure that that language enters the national conversation. So that's the key for liberals tonight. That's what progressives are focused on, is the economic message.
And speaking of national security issues, as our caller did, there's been a long line of revelations from the leaks from Edward Snowden. The president and the White House are probably not happy about that. Is that something, though, that you expect he might address in the State of the Union?
Well, again, you know, it's interesting to note that, recall that the president spoke about the NSA, the Friday before a holiday weekend, a good, you know, couple of weeks before the State of the Union. That was no coincidence. It's not necessarily an issue that he wants to dwell on. It's not an issue that he wants to spend a lot of time on. It's an issue where he gets criticism both from the right and from the left. That's not necessarily something that he wants to spend a huge amount of time on. Traditionally, when it comes to foreign policy, it tends to get sort of a short shrift in the State of the Union, right? It tends to be towards the back half of the speech. The domestic policy gets the spotlight. We do know traditionally the president is going to, pay tribute to the troops. He's probably going to talk a little bit about what the situation, obviously, in Iraq and Afghanistan, and obviously, given what's happening right now when it comes to Ukraine, all eyes on the situation there, wouldn't be surprising to hear him make a mention of that as well.
Representative Kathy McMorris Rodgers of Washington is going to deliver the Republican response to the State of the Union address. Why her? She's not a big national profile speaker for the Republicans.
Well, you know, this speaker, you know, one of the questions that we've had from people was, everyone was wondering whether some kind of, recent controversial comments at the RNC meeting here in Washington may have had something to do with the selection of a woman to deliver the response to the president. That's actually not the case. That selection was set well beforehand. But, she's someone who has been, she's someone who is not necessarily a surprise pick for this particular position. She's considered a rising star within the party. She is someone who can talk about her family experience. The Speaker of the House, John Boehner, said that she's going to be talking about, issues that she's faced through the lens of her own family's experience. And so this comes, again, at a time when her party is trying to make inroads with women and members of minority groups and others. And so this is part of that outreach.
What do we expect in her speech? Anything that she's likely to highlight?
Well, no surprise. You can expect to hear from her criticism of the Affordable Care Act. Republicans have been coming out with fresh ideas for ways that they might want to replace it. And so, that's certainly going to be a strong focus tonight in the Republican response. Just one of several Republican responses. There's actually four or five responses out there from the official Republican response to the Tea Party response, a response from Senator Rand Paul and others. So a lot of Republican pushback after the president speaks tonight.
Just briefly, we in the media get excited about States of the Union and these speeches. Do they matter? Are they a big deal?
And this is the question. You know, we're always kind of looking for a State of the Union bounce. Clearly, the president is going to be heading out on a barnstorming tour, hitting a couple of states over the next few days, really pushing the economic message off of his speech today. It's not so much about the night. It's about what happens afterwards. You know, whether it doesn't change the underlying dynamic. So it's really more of a one-off. You know, it's not so much about what happens while he's speaking to the public, while he's speaking to Congress this evening. It's going to be about what happens after he leaves the podium.
Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Rebecca Cinderbrand. She's Deputy White House Editor at Politico. We've been talking about tonight's State of the Union Address.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a look at how drones could be used and misused in hunting in Wisconsin.
First, there may be a showdown in northern Wisconsin over access to a proposed mining site. A new state law limits access to the site of a proposed iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin's Pinocchio Range, and protesters vowed yesterday to continue hiking in the area.
Mike Simonson joins us now. He's WPR's reporter in Superior. He's been tracking this story. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So give us, please, a bit of the recent history. Why did this off-limit zone get put into place?
Well, it's kind of a work in progress, this whole mining thing. You guys, I know, have covered it very closely as well. But in June, when they first began exploratory drilling, the first day of the drilling, there was a band of a dozen or more masked people who literally raided the drill site. It was a confrontation with a lot of swearing, and it was rather intimidating. That started then that GTAC came in with bulletproof security, an Arizona firm that was showing automatic weapons and dressed in camouflage. Then the legislature stepped in and said, hey, you know, we need to have an off-limits safety zone for a couple of reasons. One, to protect workers from raids or whatever, and the other one is to protect the public in case they are out hiking and unaware of what's going on, that the area is posted, so if there is some activity, that they're not near the machinery and that sort of thing.
And this off-limit zone kicks in this weekend, is that right?
Yeah, actually, it's in effect right now.
Oh.
And yeah, I mean, there haven't been any confrontations so far, but there's really a competition to see who can get the first ticket by the protesters.
And we've heard this week from people opposed to the mine and wanting to have access to this site. What are you hearing from them? Why do they oppose this off-limits zone?
They want to be able to monitor what's going on there. They want to be able to see if while they're drilling, while GTAC is drilling, if there are any spills, if the holes have anything kicked back, any waste rock. That is just a lot of streams, a very sensitive area, a very natural area. They want to be able to document all of the activity that they say is disruptive to the Pinokies.
You mentioned that there was more or less a contest to see who might get the first citation. What kind of things are protesters talking about doing to protest, I guess, both the mine and this exclusion zone?
Well, they're talking about the Golden Goose Award, trying to find an egg hunt or something like that. But and the egg, I guess, is a ticket. It's a peaceful thing. They're planning on and have been snowshoeing in the area. They've been taking pictures of this of themselves in the off-limits area. The sheriff's departments in Iron and Ashland County have followed that. Nobody's being secretive of it. They're trying to keep it upbeat. But, you know, even below all of this, this could be a serious thing. If somebody notches it up and if either on law enforcement or GTAC or the protesters, this may not be funny anymore.
You mentioned that protesters have been public about their opposition and their plans to go onto this site. What have you heard from police as far as enforcement?
They're going to enforce it as trespassing. Ironically, I asked the district attorney in Iron County and I asked the two sheriffs, Sheriff Brennan and Furick of Ashland and Iron County, so you write them a ticket and that's for how much? And they're not sure because the statute isn't clear, but a normal trespassing ticket would be at least $200. But they're not sure. The DA isn't sure. The sheriff's not sure. They don't write, you know, usually you don't have to write tickets for people walking in the woods. So this is, again, breaking new ground. But the sheriff's departments, this is a pain for them. These are small departments in very geologically large areas, and they have other work to do as well. So it's no joke to them, and they're going to enforce it. But they're going to enforce it only if GTAC complains, and GTAC has brought in their own security firm. They won't say how many and who it is, if it's bulletproof, but Sheriff Brennan told me that they are unarmed.
So, and that's been GTAC's statement on this. They've got their security. They will report incidents to the police as they happen?
Yeah. I mean, unless it's like that raid in June, which is a very isolated incident. It's the only time there was a confrontation. Otherwise, everything's been very friendly, very civil. But in case it is something where they believe that their workers are in danger, then apparently the private security would take action to protect the geologists and the drillers.
Getting back to state law briefly, this no-fly zone or no-walk zone, no-hike zone, it doesn't specify any particular additional punishment beyond whatever the local trespassing ordinances might be?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's part of the thing that we're going to find out this week. If the sheriff writes out a ticket, and here's your ticket, you know, you got to go to court on this date, but the protester says, but I'm not leaving. Well, that means that they'll probably have to arrest that person. Now, keep in mind that last weekend, 50 people went snowshoeing in the off-limits zone from the LCO Harvest Project area, and it could be 100 people next weekend. Iron County, Ashland County, they don't have the resources to, they don't have any paddy wagons.
Is there talk of, maybe this is too soon to ask this question, is there talk of bringing in outside enforcement? I don't know who that would be, state police or DNR wardens or somebody to help those local police units.
Yeah, it's a possibility. The governor says that he's not going to activate the National Guard, but there is there are DNR wardens, and there is mutual assistance with the local police departments, Ashland PD or Mercer or Hurley, and I suppose that could happen. It's maybe they just want to make the point of, we don't think any public lands should be off limits. This is our land, and we should be able to observe it. We should be able to use it.
Civil disobedience, is that, do you think, going to be the wave of the future for protesters as this project goes forward?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think they're going to fight this any way they can. Probably the most effective would be in the courts. The tribes certainly have taken a lead role in doing that, and they're using the federal government. And the feds have already said they don't like the way the state's going to go about the new permitting process from the new rules, permitting rules passed last year. So they're going to take a separate road. So I think courts, but also, you know, PR, staying out in the public eye, which is a pretty easy thing to do because this story is being washed around the country.
Mike, you put up another story that went nuts around the world about mainly a picture, the ice caves up on the Apostle Islands sea caves that are all iced over. Is there some kind of connection? Are protesters using that, mining opponents using that to try to strengthen their case?
Right. The sea caves are quite a ways away, but it is on Lake Superior. And the Smithsonian Magazine ran a story from the story that we ran, and the comments were from largely from the anti-mining people, so they have a national forum to do that. They said, look, Lake Superior is beautiful. These caves are incredible. Look at this. This is being threatened by this mining project because the hill runs down into the Bad River watershed and ultimately into Lake Superior. So, yeah, the Smithsonian Magazine is being used right now.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Yeah, you bet, Rob.
That's Mike Simonson. He's WPR's Superior Bureau reporter. Drones are in the news a lot for their military uses, but they're picking up popularity in the civilian world for work and for hobbies.
Our next guest is thinking ahead about how drones might be used in hunting here in Wisconsin. In a recent piece, he wrote about ethical issues drones could raise. Paul Smith joins us now. He's outdoors editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, I wonder if we could start by having you give us some examples so we have in mind the kinds of ethical issues that we're talking about as we go into the discussion. What sorts of things could drones be used for in hunting that are unethical?
Well, in hunting in Wisconsin, for instance, they're not only unethical, but they're illegal. So we have a state law that would prohibit the use of drones for hunting. It's in our state administrative code. And the way it appears is that it's a rule that governs aircraft, but our DNR has said that that drones fit the definition of aircraft. So it would be illegal to use drones to scout, harass, herd, or hunt game in Wisconsin. So it's not only unethical, but it's illegal.
So even if it's not legal, as drones become more available, do you think some people will try to use them for hunting in some of the ways you just talked about, herding or harassing wildlife, that kind of thing?
Sure. Well, that's one of the reasons I wrote the article, and I proposed some imaginary scenarios. The use of technology is always very tempting to human beings, and So there would be great temptation. People fly aircraft in certain parts of the world and spot game and then hunt it. To have a tool in your hands that you could fly up, look around, and find game would, I think, be certainly tempting to some. And we should always state that the vast majority of hunters are ethical and law-abiding. But this issue now, and with the increasing availability of drones, next year the Federal Aviation Administration is scheduled to publish a rule on the use of drones for commercial applications in the U.S., and when that's done, most people expect manufacturers to produce more, and the price will come down, and so the use for all applications will increase. That's what's predicted. So there would be some folks who might be tempted to try use a drone for an unethical application. Recently, for instance, the Colorado Commission of Parks and Wildlife felt it necessary to explicitly state that the use of drones is illegal in that state. Wisconsin officials haven't weighed in on that yet, Veronica, but it's possible that they might publish such information in our hunting pamphlets just to make sure people are aware of the law.
Now, you do give two or three examples, scenarios in your piece about the way drones could be used, some things you're sort of brainstorming ahead on. One of them uses drones to locate, let's say, a deer, and then the hunter can just get in position and shoot. That's one. What are some of the others? Paul, are you with us? Did we lose Paul? We had him a second ago. Well, in the meantime, tell us what you think. Are you worried about the application of drones in hunting? We talked about a scenario in which a hunter might use a drone to get up there, find the animal that the hunter's hunting, and in this case, not engage in fair chase policies and practices in hunting, but just get in position and shoot the animal. But also, PETA has said and encouraged its members to use drones to instead go and try to watch the hunters. And let's see if we have Paul back on the line with us. Paul, are you there? Let's see. Still working on getting Paul on the line. And what do you think? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. If you're a hunter, what do you think about this? Do you think this is something you're worried about? Should we be out ahead of this one and looking at it and talking about the way that technology could change things? 1-800-642-1234 as we try to get Paul Smith back on the line. Paul, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. I don't know. You dropped out on there for a moment, but you're back, so that's fantastic. And so I don't know if you heard my last question. So you ran through a few scenarios in your piece about ways that drones could be used, things that you're concerned about. And one of them, you talk about a hunter using a drone to locate the animal, then just getting in position and shooting and not really using the fair chase practices that, most hunters use. Tell us about some of the others.
Well, the, in the piece, I also propose one where someone would perhaps herd an animal into position to take a shot, even perhaps going into a neighbor's property and driving game from that location to their own. I also talk about the use, and I, before we lost contact there, I know you mentioned the PETA campaign to use drones to monitor hunter activity and to harass hunters. So we see drones surfacing on every side of the equation. That type of hunter harassment activity is illegal in Wisconsin already, and recently the state of Illinois passed a law there making it illegal in that state. One of the areas that is very interesting to me going forward is related to wildlife viewing. So not hunting, but actually wildlife viewing and the use of drones to get close to, say, nesting birds or big flocks of waterfowl.
Right, and so I guess the scenario would be something like, you know, you could watch an eagle's nest with your binoculars, or you could get right on in there with a drone camera and see things you never could have seen, you know, before. And I guess you're worried that that's going to affect the wildlife and maybe they'll leave the nest.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen videos taken with drones that get very close to some wildlife, and you can see the animals reacting to it. And if you can imagine someone who spent a lifetime looking through binoculars at birds that are perhaps at a distance of a half a mile, quarter of a mile, or using spotting scopes, and offered this option of using a drone to fly close to it, there'll be a temptation there. There aren't really, we have a wildlife harassment law in Wisconsin, but wildlife viewing is much less regulated than hunting. So it'll be interesting to see how organizations come out perhaps in and have a position statement on the use of drones in wildlife viewing. I called the National Audubon Society, for instance, and they don't have a position right now on the use of drones, or at least weren't able to locate one. As this issue moves forward, it'll be interesting to see how certain groups come out on the issue of drones.
Well, let's take a caller. We have Lacey. She's joining us from Waukun, Iowa. Hi, Lacey.
Hi.
What do you think about drones and the way we might use them?
Well, I think that it's kind of cheating. The fun of hunting is, like, tracking them, too. And only people who have more money will be able to use the drones. It wouldn't be fair to the other people.
Right, so you're saying it could give some people the advantage in hunting, and also Lacey's getting at the fair chase sort of ethic of behind hunting. What would you say to that, Paul?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I would agree 100%, and every ethical hunter would, and that's the point, one of the points that the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, that's a conservation organization, they came out in January and issued a statement making exactly those points, that it violates fair chase, and also it violates this tenet that we have that game should be available to all of us, and not just wealthy or not allocated by means of ability to get at it through different means. So, I would agree, and she's making points that hopefully. You know, Veronica, I haven't called all around the country to find what laws are in place in different states, but I believe most would already outlaw the use of drones in this way that Lacey said. It's cheating.
Do you think that the hunting community in Wisconsin and beyond will coalesce on a point of view about this, or is this something that's going to be contentious down the road? Some people are going to want to use drones to hunt.
Yeah, it's a great idea. A great question. I believe they will coalesce around it, and I think as it becomes more feasible to consider, right now you can't walk into sporting goods stores that I know of and buy a drone. But I wouldn't rule that out. It's probably a question of when, right? When we can go to our various commercial outlets of any sort and buy one. So I think that over the next couple of years, I believe we'll start to see various organizations and bodies take positions on it and coalesce around it. I know there's already an unofficial consensus in the hunting community that the use of drones is unethical, illegal, and should not be pursued.
Well, in our last 30 seconds here, could drones be used, you know, on the other side to catch poachers, maybe, for example?
Absolutely. I think, and they are used in Africa for that purpose now. There are also some very good, we should say, that there are excellent uses of drones, very constructive, productive uses, including for monitoring remote wildlife. In Indonesia, they're used to monitor orangutans high in the trees. So
that's another aspect. And we're going to have to leave it there, Paul. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay. Thank you.
That was Paul Smith, outdoors editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about his recent piece on drones, hunting, and ethics.
Coming up.